Shall we go? I'll take you home. She rose, and he held her coat for her. It was a wide, loose garment, and his hands guided it to enfold her body. She felt his arm remain about her shoulders a moment longer than he intended her to notice. She glanced back at him, but he was standing oddly still, staring intently down at the table. In rising, they had brushed aside the mats of paper lace, and she saw an inscription cut into the plastic of the tabletop. Attempts had been made to erase it, but the inscription remained, as the graven voice of some unknown drunk's despair. Who is John Galt? With a brusque movement of anger, she flicked the mat back to cover the words. He chuckled. I can answer it, he said. I can tell you who is John Galt. Really? Everybody seems to know him, but they never tell the same story twice. They're all true, though, all the stories you've heard about him. Well, what's yours? Who is he? John Galt is Prometheus, who changed his mind. After centuries of being torn by vultures in payment for having brought to men the fire of the gods, he broke his chains and he withdrew his fire, until the day when men withdraw their vultures. The band of cross ties swept in wide curves around granite corners, clinging to the mountainsides of Colorado. Dagny walked down the ties, keeping her hands in her coat pockets and her eyes on the meaningless distance ahead. Only the familiar movement of straining her steps to the spacing of the ties gave her the physical sense of an action pertaining to a railroad. A gray cotton, which was neither quite fog nor clouds, hung in sloppy wads between sky and mountains, making the sky look like an old mattress spilling its stuffing down the sides of the peaks. A crusted snow covered the ground, belonging neither to winter nor to spring. A net of moisture hung in the air, and she felt an icy pinprick on her face once in a while, which was neither a raindrop nor a snowflake. The weather seemed afraid to take a stand, and clung noncommittally to some sort of road's middle. Board of Directors weather, she thought. The light seemed drained, and she could not tell whether this was the afternoon or the evening of March 31st. But she was very certain that it was March 31st. That was a certainty not to be escaped. She had come to Colorado with Hank Reardon to buy whatever machinery could still be found in the closed factories. It had been like a hurried search through the sinking hulk of a great ship before it was to vanish out of reach. They could have given the task to employees, but they had come, both prompted by the same unconfessed motive. They could not resist the desire to attend the run of the last train, as one cannot resist the desire to give a last salute by attending a funeral, even while knowing that it is only an act of self-torture. They had been buying machinery from doubtful owners in sales of dubious legality, since nobody could tell who had the right to dispose of the great dead properties, and nobody would come to challenge the transactions. They had bought everything that could be moved from the gutted plant of Nielsen Motors. Ted Nielsen had quit and vanished a week after the announcement that the line was to be closed. She had felt like a scavenger, but the activity of the hunt had made her able to bear these past few days. When she had found that 3 empty hours remained before the departure of the last train, she had gone to walk through the countryside to escape the stillness of the town. She had walked at random through twisting mountain trails, alone among rocks and snow, trying to substitute motion for thought, knowing that she had to get through this day without thinking of the summer when she had ridden the engine of the first train. But she found herself walking back along the roadbed of the John Galt line, and she knew that she had intended it, that she had gone out for that purpose. It was a spur track which had already been dismembered. There were no signal lights, no switches, no telephone wires, nothing, but a long band of wooden strips on the ground, a chain of ties without rail, like the remnant of a spine, and as its lonely guardian, at an abandoned grade crossing, a pole with slanted arms saying, "Stop, look, listen." An early darkness mixed with fog was slipping down to fill the valleys when she came upon the factory. There was an inscription high on the lustrous tile of its front wall. Roger Marsh, Electrical Appliances. The man who had wanted to chain himself to his desk in order not to leave this, she thought. The building stood intact, like a corpse in that instant when its eyes have just closed and one still waits to see them open again. She felt that the lights would flare up at any moment behind the great sheets of windows, under the long, flat roofs. Then she saw one broken pane, pierced by a stone for some young moron's enjoyment. And she saw the tall, dry stem of a single weed rising from the steps of the main entrance. Hit by a sudden, blinding hatred, in rebellion against the weed's impertinence, knowing of what enemy this was the scout, she ran forward, she fell on her knees, and jerked the weed up by its roots. Then, kneeling on the steps of a closed factory, looking at the vast silence of mountains, brush, and dusk, she thought, "What do you think you're doing?" It was almost dark when she reached the end of the ties that led her back to the town of Marshville. Marshville had been the end of the line for months past. Service to Wyatt Junction had been discontinued long ago. Dr. Ferris's reclamation project had been abandoned this winter. The street lights were on, and they hung in midair at the intersections in a long, diminishing line of yellow globes over the empty streets of Marshville. All the better homes were closed, the neat, sturdy houses of modest cost, well-built and well-kept. There were faded for-sale signs on their lawns. But she saw lights in the windows of the cheap, garish structures that had acquired, within a few years, the slovenly dilapidation of slum hovels, the homes of people who had not moved, the people who never looked beyond the span of 1 week. She saw a large new television set in the lighted room of a house with a sagging roof and cracking walls. She wondered how long they expected the electric power companies of Colorado to remain in existence. Then she shook her head. Those people had never known that power companies existed. The main street of Marshville was lined by the black windows of shops out of business. All the luxury stores are gone, she thought, looking at their signs. And then she shuddered, realizing what things she now called luxury, realizing to what extent and in what manner those things, once available to the poorest, had been luxuries. Dry cleaning, electrical appliances, gas station, drugstore, 5 and 10. The only ones left open were grocery stores and saloons. The platform of the railroad station was crowded. The glaring arc lights seemed to pick it out of the mountains, to isolate and focus it, like a small stage on which every movement was naked to the sight of the unseen tiers rising in the vast encircling night. People were carting luggage, bundling their children, haggling at ticket windows. The stifled panic of their manner suggesting that what they really wanted to do was to fall down on the ground and scream with terror. Their terror had the evasive quality of guilt. It was not the fear that comes from understanding, but from the refusal to understand. The last train stood at the platform, its windows a long, lone streak of light. The steam of the locomotive, gasping tensely through the wheels, did not have its usual joyous sound of energy released for a sprint. It had the sound of a panting breath that one dreads to hear, and dreads more to stop hearing. Far at the end of the lighted windows, she saw the small red dot of a lantern attached to her private car. Beyond the lantern, there was nothing but a black void. The train was loaded to capacity, and the shrill notes of hysteria and the confusion of voices were the pleas for space in vestibules and aisles. Some people were not leaving, but stood in vapid curiosity, watching the show. They had come as if knowing that this was the last event they would ever witness in their community, and perhaps in their lives. She walked hastily through the crowd, trying not to look at anyone. Some knew who she was, most of them did not. She saw an old woman with a ragged shawl on her shoulders and the graph of a lifetime struggle on the cracked skin of her face. The woman's glance was a hopeless appeal for help. An unshaved young man with gold-rimmed glasses stood on a crate under an arc light, yelling to the faces shifting past him. "What do they mean, no business? Look at that train, it's full of passengers, there's plenty of business. It's just that there's no profits for them. That's why they're letting you perish, those greedy parasites." A disheveled woman rushed up to Dagny, waving two tickets and screaming something about the wrong date. Dagny found herself pushing people out of the way, fighting to reach the end of the train. But an emaciated man with the staring eyes of years of malicious futility rushed at her, shouting, "It's all right for you, you've got a good overcoat and a private car, but you won't give us any trains, you and all the selfish—" He stopped abruptly, looking at someone behind her. She felt a hand grasping her elbow. It was Hank Reardon. He held her arm and led her toward her car. Seeing the look on his face, she understood why people got out of their way. At the end of the platform, a pallid, plumpish man stood, saying to a crying woman, "That's how it's always been in this world. There will be no chance for the poor until the rich are destroyed." High above the town, hanging in black space like an uncooled planet, the flame of Wyatt's torch was twisting in the wind. Reardon went inside her car, but she remained on the steps of the vestibule, delaying the finality of turning away. She heard the "all aboard." She looked at the people who remained on the platform, as one looks at those who watched the departure of the last lifeboat. The conductor stood below at the foot of the steps, with his lantern in one hand and his watch in the other. He glanced at the watch, then glanced up at her face. She answered by the silent affirmation of closing her eyes and inclining her head. She saw his lantern circling through the air as she turned away. And the first jolt of the wheels, on the rails of Reardon metal, was made easier for her by the sight of Reardon as she pulled the door open and went into her car. When James Taggart telephoned Lillian Reardon from New York and said, "Why, no special reason. Just wondered how you were and whether you ever came to the city. Haven't seen you for ages and just thought we might have lunch together next time you're in New York." She knew that he had some very special reason in mind. When she answered lazily, "Oh, let me see. What day is this? April 2nd? Let me look in my calendar. Why, it just so happens that I have some shopping to do in New York tomorrow, so I'll be delighted to let you save me my lunch money." He knew that she had no shopping to do, and that the luncheon would be the only purpose of her trip to the city. They met in a distinguished, high-priced restaurant, much too distinguished and high-priced ever to be mentioned in the gossip columns, not the kind of place which James Taggart, always eager for personal publicity, was in the habit of patronizing. He did not want them to be seen together, she concluded. The half-hint of half-secret amusement remained on her face while she listened to him talking about their friends, the theater, and the weather, carefully building for himself the protection of the unimportant. She sat gracefully, not quite straight, as if she were leaning back, enjoying the futility of his performance and the fact that he had to stage it for her benefit. She waited with patient curiosity to discover his purpose. "I do think that you deserve a pat on the back, or a medal or something, Jim," she said, "for being remarkably cheerful in spite of all the messy trouble you're having. Didn't you just close the best branch of your railroad?"
"Oh, it's only a slight financial setback, nothing more. One has to expect retrenchments at a time like this. Considering the general state of the country, we're doing quite well, better than the rest of them."
He added, shrugging,
"Besides, it's a matter of opinion whether the Rio Norte line was our best branch. It is only my sister who thought so. It was her pet project."
She caught the tone of pleasure, blurring the drawl of his syllables. She smiled and said,
"I see."
Looking up at her from under his lowered forehead, as if stressing that he expected her to understand, Taggart asked,
"How is he taking it?"
"Who?" She understood quite well.
"Your husband?"
"Taking what?"
"The closing of that line."
She smiled gaily.
"Your guess is as good as mine, Jim. And mine is very good indeed."
"What do you mean?"
"You know how he would take it. Just as you know how your sister is taking it. So your cloud has a double silver lining, hasn't it?"
"What has he been saying in the last few days?"
"He's been away in Colorado for over a week, so I..."
She stopped. She had started answering lightly, but she noticed that Taggart's question had been too specific, while his tone had been too casual, and she realized that he had struck the first note leading toward the purpose of the luncheon. She paused for the briefest instant, then finished still more lightly.
"So I wouldn't know, but he's coming back any day now.
Would you say that his attitude is still what one might call recalcitrant?"
"Why, Jim, that would be an understatement."
It was to be hoped that events had perhaps taught him the wisdom of a mellower approach. It amused her to keep him in doubt about her understanding.
"Oh, yes," she said innocently. It would be wonderful if anything could ever make him change. He is making things exceedingly hard for himself. He always has. But events have a way of beating us all into a more pliable frame of mind sooner or later. I've heard many characteristics ascribed to him, but pliable has never been one of them. Well, things change, and people change with them. After all, it is a law of nature that animals must adapt themselves to their background, and I might add that adaptability is the one characteristic most stringently required at present by laws other than those of nature. We're in for a very difficult time, and I would hate to see you suffer the consequences of his intransigent attitude. I would hate, as your friend, to see him in the kind of danger he's headed for unless he learns to cooperate. How sweet of you, Jim, she said sweetly. He was doling his sentences out with cautious slowness, balancing himself between word and intonation to hit the right degree of semi-clarity. He wanted her to understand, but he did not want her to understand fully, explicitly, down to the root, since the essence of that modern language which he had learned to speak expertly was never to let oneself or others understand anything down to the root. He had not needed many words to understand Mr. Weatherby. On his last trip to Washington, he had pleaded with Mr. Weatherby that a cut in the rates of the railroads would be a death blow. The wage raises had been granted, but the demands for the cut in rates were still heard in the press, and Taggart had known what it meant if Mr. Mooch still permitted them to be heard. He had known that the knife was still poised at his throat. Mr. Weatherby had not answered his pleas, but had said in a tone of idly irrelevant speculation, "Wesley has so many tough problems. If he is to give everybody a breathing spell, financially speaking, he's got to put into operation a certain emergency program, of which you have some inkling. But you know what hell the unprogressive elements of the country would raise about it. A man like Reardon, for instance. We don't want any more stunts of the sort he's liable to pull. Wesley would give a lot for somebody who could keep Reardon in line. But I guess that's something nobody can deliver, though I may be wrong. You may know better, Jim, since Reardon is a sort of friend of yours who comes to your parties and all that." Looking at Lillian across the table, Taggart said, "Friendship, I find, is the most valuable thing in life, and I would be amiss if I didn't give you proof of mine." "But I've never doubted it." He lowered his voice to the tone of an ominous warning. "I think I should tell you, as a favor to a friend, although it's confidential, that your husband's attitude is being discussed in high places. Very high places. I'm sure you know what I mean." This was why he hated Lillian Reardon, thought Taggart. She knew the game, but she played it with unexpected variations of her own. It was against all rules to look at him suddenly, to laugh in his face. And after all those remarks showing that she understood too little, to say bluntly, showing that she understood too much, "Why, darling, of course I know what you mean. You mean that the purpose of this very excellent luncheon was not a favor you wanted to do me, but a favor you wanted to get from me. You mean that it's you who are in danger, and could use that favor to great advantage for a trade in high places. And you mean that you are reminding me of my promise to deliver the goods." "The sort of performance he put on at his trial was hardly what I'd call delivering the goods," he said angrily. "It wasn't what you had led me to expect." "Oh, my, no, it wasn't," she said placidly. "It certainly wasn't. But, darling, did you expect me not to know that after that performance of his, he wouldn't be very popular in high places? Did you really think you had to tell me that as a confidential favor?"
"But it's true. I heard him discussed, so I thought I'd tell you."
"I'm sure it's true. I know that they would be discussing him. I know also that if there were anything they could do to him, they would have done it right after his trial. My, would they have been glad to do it. So I know that he's the only one among you who is in no danger whatever at the moment. I know that it's they who are afraid of him. Do you see how well I understand what you mean, darling?"
"Well, if you think you do, I must say that for my part I don't understand you at all. I don't know what it is that you're doing."
"Why, I'm just setting things straight, so that you'll know that I know how much you need me. And now that it's straight, I'll tell you the truth in my turn. I didn't double-cross you. I merely failed. His performance at the trial, I didn't expect it any more than you did. Less. I had good reason not to expect it. But something went wrong. I don't know what it was. I am trying to find out. When I do, I will keep my promise. Then you'll be free to take full credit for it and to tell your friends in high places that it's you who've disarmed him."
"Lillian," he said nervously, I meant it when I said that I was anxious to give you proof of my friendship. So if there's anything I can do for—"
She laughed. "There isn't. I know you meant it. But there's nothing you can do for me, no favor of any kind, no trade. I'm a truly non-commercial person. I want nothing in return. Tough luck, Jim. You'll just have to remain at my mercy."
"But then why should you want to do it at all? What are you getting out of it?"
She leaned back, smiling. "This lunch. Just seeing you here. Just knowing that you had to come to me." An angry spark flashed in Taggart's veiled eyes. Then his eyelids narrowed slowly, and he too leaned back in his chair, his face relaxing to a faint look of mockery and satisfaction. Even from within that unstated, unnamed, undefined muck, which represented his code of values, he was able to realize which one of them was the more dependent on the other, and the more contemptible. When they parted at the door of the restaurant, she went to Reardon's suite at the Wayne Falkland Hotel, where she stayed occasionally in his absence. She paced the room for about half an hour, in a leisurely manner of reflection. Then she picked up the telephone with a smoothly casual gesture, but with the purposeful air of a decision reached. She called Reardon's office at the Mills and asked Miss Ives when she expected him to return. "Mr. Reardon will be in New York tomorrow, arriving on the Comet, Mrs. Reardon," said Miss Ives, clear, courteous voice.
"Tomorrow, that's wonderful. Miss Ives, would you do me a favor? Would you call Gertrude at the house and tell her not to expect me for dinner? I'm staying in New York overnight."
She hung up, glanced at her watch, and called the florist of the Wayne Falkland.
"This is Mrs. Henry Reardon," she said. "I should like to have 2 dozen roses delivered to Mr. Reardon's drawing room aboard the Comet." "Yes, today, this afternoon, when the Comet reaches Chicago." "No, without any card. Just the flowers." "Thank you ever so much."
She telephoned James Taggart.
"Jim, will you send me a pass to your passenger platforms? I want to meet my husband at the station tomorrow."
She hesitated between Balfe Eubank and Bertram Scudder, chose Balfe Eubank, telephoned him, and made a date for this evening's dinner and a musical show. Then she went to take a bath and lay relaxing in a tub of warm water, reading a magazine devoted to problems of political economy. It was late afternoon when the florist telephoned her.
"Our Chicago office sent word that they were unable to deliver the flowers, Mrs. Reardon," he said, "because Mr. Reardon is not aboard the Comet."
"Are you sure?" she asked.
"Quite sure, Mrs. Reardon. Our man found at the station in Chicago that there was no compartment on the train reserved in Mr. Reardon's name. We checked with the New York office of Taggart Transcontinental, just to make certain, and we're told that Mr. Reardon's name is not on the passenger list of the Comet."
"I see. Then cancel the order, please." "Thank you."
She sat by the telephone for a moment, frowning, then called Miss Ives.
"Please forgive me for being slightly scatterbrained, Miss Ives, but I was rushed and did not write it down, and now I'm not quite certain of what you said. Did you say that Mr. Reardon was coming back tomorrow? On the Comet?"
"Yes, Mrs. Reardon." "You have not heard of any delay or change in his plans?"
"Why, no. In fact, I spoke to Mr. Reardon about an hour ago. He telephoned from the station in Chicago, and he mentioned that he had to hurry back aboard as the Comet was about to leave." "I see. Thank you."
She leaped to her feet as soon as the click of the instrument restored her to privacy. She started pacing the room, her steps now unrhythmically tense. Then she stopped, struck by a sudden thought. There was only one reason why a man would make a train reservation under an assumed name: if he was not traveling alone. Her facial muscles went flowing slowly into a smile of satisfaction. This was an opportunity she had not expected. Standing on the terminal platform at a point halfway down the length of the train, Lillian Reardon watched the passengers descending from the Comet. Her mouth held the hint of a smile. There was a spark of animation in her lifeless eyes. She glanced from one face to another, jerking her head with the awkward eagerness of a schoolgirl. She was anticipating the look on Reardon's face when, with his mistress beside him, he would see her standing there. Her glance darted hopefully to every flashy young female stepping off the train. It was hard to watch. Within an instant after the first few figures, the train had seemed to burst at the seams, flooding the platform with a solid current that swept in one direction, as if pulled by a vacuum. She could barely distinguish separate persons. The lights were more glare than illumination, picking this one strip out of a dusty, oily darkness.
She needed an effort to stand still against the invisible pressure of motion. Her first sight of Reardon in the crowd came as a shock. She had not seen him step out of a car, but there he was, walking in her direction from somewhere far down the length of the train. He was alone. He was walking with his usual purposeful speed, his hands in the pockets of his trench coat. There was no woman beside him, no companion of any kind, except a porter hurrying along with a bag she recognized as his. In a fury of incredulous disappointment, she looked frantically for any single feminine figure he could have left behind. She felt certain that she would recognize his choice. She saw none that could be possible. And then she saw that the last car of the train was a private car, and that the figure standing at its door talking to some station official, a figure wearing not minks and veils but a rough sports coat that stressed the incomparable grace of a slender body in the confident posture of this station's owner and center, was Dagny Taggart. Then Lillian Reardon understood. "Lillian, what's the matter?" She heard Reardon's voice. She felt his hand grasping her arm. She saw him looking at her as one looks at the object of a sudden emergency. He was looking at a blank face and an unfocused glance of terror. "What happened? What are you doing here?"
Hello, Henry. I just came to meet you. No special reason. I just wanted to meet you."
The terror was gone from her face, but she spoke in a strange, flat voice.
"I wanted to see you. It was an impulse, a sudden impulse, and I couldn't resist it because—"
"But you looked ill."
"No. No, maybe I felt faint. It's stuffy here. I couldn't resist coming because it made me think of the days when you would have been glad to see me. It was a moment's illusion to recreate for myself."
The words sounded like a memorized lesson. She knew that she had to speak, while her mind was fighting to grasp the full meaning of her discovery. The words were part of the plan she had intended to use, if she had met him after he had found the roses in his compartment. He did not answer. He stood watching her, frowning.
"I missed you, Henry. I know what I'm confessing, but I don't expect it to mean anything to you any longer."
The words did not fit the tight face, the lips that moved with effort, the eyes that kept glancing away from him down the length of the platform.
I merely wanted to surprise you."
A look of shrewdness and purpose was returning to her face. He took her arm, but she drew back, a little too sharply.
"Aren't you going to say a word to me, Henry?"
"What do you wish me to say?"
"Do you hate it as much as that? Having your wife come to meet you at the station?"
She glanced down the platform. Dagny Taggart was walking toward them. He did not see her. "Let's go," he said. She would not move.
"Do you?"
she asked.
"What?" "Do you hate it?"
"No, I don't hate it. I merely don't understand it."
"Tell me about your trip. I'm sure you've had a very enjoyable trip."
"Come on, we can talk at home."
"When do I ever have a chance to talk to you at home?"
She was drawling her words impassively, as if she were stretching them to fill time for some reason which he could not imagine.
"I had hoped to catch a few moments of your attention, like this, between trains and business appointments, and all those important matters that hold you day and night, all those great achievements of yours, such as—" "Hello, Miss Taggart," she said sharply, her voice loud and bright.
Reardon whirled around. Dagny was walking past them, but she stopped. "How do you do?" she said to Lillian, bowing, her face expressionless.
"I am so sorry, Miss Taggart," said Lillian, smiling. "You must forgive me if I don't know the appropriate formula of condolences for the occasion."
She noted that Dagny and Reardon had not greeted each other.
"You're returning from what was, in effect, the funeral of your child by my husband, aren't you?"
Dagny's mouth showed a faint line of astonishment and of contempt. She inclined her head by way of leave-taking and walked on. Lillian glanced sharply at Reardon's face, as if in deliberate emphasis. He looked at her indifferently, puzzled. She said nothing. She followed him without a word when he turned to go.
She remained silent in the taxicab, her face half turned away from him while they rode to the Wayne Falkland Hotel. He felt certain, as he looked at the tautly twisted set of her mouth, that some uncustomary violence was raging within her. He had never known her to experience a strong emotion of any kind. She whirled to face him the moment they were alone in his room. "So that's who it is?" she asked.